Meanwhile, Jeremy is watching the visions and just going, "Stop staring at me, Swan!" And that's all he took from that. So,
welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region; no guarantees implied. Here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
Miranda, I feel perfectly awful. When are we going home? Miranda?
Everyone, welcome to Wreckatopia. This is episode 186. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello, one and all.
And Aaron Dicer.
Howdy ho, Miranda Renos.
That's right. We'd also like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. We appreciate you very much. Thanks for coming out. Today's big recommend is Picnic at Hanging Rock from 1975. Let's get on to our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And I finally watched a documentary that I actually wanted to see in theaters, and it just came and went. But, you know, that's what happens with these. I think it's like Netflix-created type of things or whatever. But I watched a documentary called Becoming Led Zeppelin. I don't think there is a band on Earth I know more about than Led Zeppelin. Back in the 90s, a couple of friends and I were big, huge Led Zeppelin people and bought all their albums and, you know, listened about every song they've ever created. I can't say that about most bands, even bands that I really love. I don't think I could say that about, but Becoming Led Zeppelin is exactly as the title states. It starts telling their stories from their early ages and how they ended up meeting each other and how they ended up forming a band. Of course, they were all in different bands and different musical ventures, and then, you know, all that serendipity and everything ends up getting these four together. And of course they find out that they are awesome together and everything. And it really just gets into the whole story of, like, you know, what it was like just create, like forming the band, and creating those first songs. And the very unusual, these guys are all from the UK. The very unusual thing of how they sold their first album, basically they mixed it and made their album. They didn't have a demo. They sent it to Atlantic. Atlantic wanted it. They just said, all right, we're basically just naming our price because we know you want this. And they bought it. But Atlantic also did the unusual thing of saying, let's start you touring in the States, and we're not even going to release this album in the UK until much later. So basically, they come over to the States, and they do this tour, and there's all this kind of underground radio and everything. Like, that's the fascinating thing about how things became huge back in the 60s and 70s. Like, today, it's like somebody, some influencer finds something on, you know, Spotify and says, hey, yeah, Listen to this band, and suddenly they're big or whatever. And back then, you know, they had to, like, they would play entire albums on the radio, on, like, FM radio. They would play entire albums.
Wow.
And, like, people would be listening to it, and they'd be, oh yeah, I want to see them and everything. And so they started doing these shows, and at first they're opening for bands, and then but Zeppelin is one of those that bands that just blew the doors off the place. So a lot of people didn't want to have them open for them because it's like Zeppelin coming out and just blowing the doors off. And then you have this other band that comes out that's not nearly as powerful, comes out trying to top that. But it's amazing to me just hearing the story about them being in the States, and their album isn't even out in their hometown yet. And they're huge in the States. They're just huge. And then they come back to England. Nobody knows who they are. Anyway, fascinating documentary. I don't think it goes nearly as far as I'd like it to, because the title does basically tell you where you're going with us. It's the very beginnings of it. it's the first couple of albums. We don't hear anything about the other albums or any or the fights or anything like that that would happen later. We don't hear a lot of that stuff. So there is something lacking about this documentary. However, if you're a big Led Zeppelin fan like me, take a look at this. I think you will enjoy it.
Would you say Led Zeppelin is your favorite band?
I would say they used to be, maybe. They used to be. I don't listen to them nearly as much as I used to. But there are certain songs that come on, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot how great this song was. Yeah. Oh, my God. And really, honestly, there's only a few clunkers, at least to me. If you look at the whole thing, I've got like the whole box set and I've got the other recordings that they did and all of that. There might be three or four songs that may not hit for me. And even those are like, oh, I kind of see what they were doing there, you know, that type of thing. But yeah, back in the 90s, I would say they were my favorite band easily. Yeah.
I thought this doc was okay. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. It feels to me like a very topic-based recommend. Like if you love Led Zeppelin, like you said, I think, you know, the doc is going to speak to you in a lot of ways. I'm not a huge Led Zeppelin fan. In fact, I'm woefully undereducated on them and their music. Mm-hmm. And so I was hoping for more. I was hoping to learn more about them, not just the facts of what they released or how they released it, but like, you know, why they are who they are. But it felt like the doc was more interested in playing a lot of music. Like there is a lot of montage in this to Led Zeppelin music. And so I occasionally just kind of, my brain kind of wandered off because I don't know the music that well. But yeah, it's pieced together fine. And there are plenty of talking heads telling you, you know, interesting facts and that kind of stuff. So
yeah. And I probably would caveat that to say, if you kind of must have to be a big Led Zeppelin fan to really enjoy this. I don't think you could probably. It's like, you know, handing me a documentary about Fleetwood Mac. I would love the Fleetwood Mac one, though.
That would be wild.
I came off the top of my head, and that was the wrong band to choose. That would have been a perfect documentary. Cheap Trick. Let's do that. Cheap Trick.
Nice.
Yeah, and even as someone who loves Led Zeppelin, I found some of the things lacking because I was hoping that there's a story in here. There was the big legend about how they got their name was that Keith Moon said, oh, those four in a band, that'll go over like a lead balloon, and it became Led Zeppelin or whatever. In this documentary, Jimmy Page is like, Keith Moon came up with the name.
Yeah.
And then they just move on, and they don't they don't explain the myths and the legends behind it or anything like that. So like that was one disappointing thing for me. But this has a lot of stuff in here that I had never seen before. Some live performances I had never seen. It's got that they've either remastered the audio on or they've done some tricks to it or whatever. But I really enjoyed it, and again, yeah, you might want to be into Led Zeppelin before you watch this, but yeah. Anyway, I found it really good. Aaron, what do you got?
Well, staying in the world of music, I saw the new Springsteen biopic, Deliver Me From Nowhere. This is Jeremy Allen White playing Bruce Springsteen, Jeremy Strong playing his, I'm going to say, manager, friend, like, you know, the guy that is the connection for Springsteen to the music world.
Is Jeremy Irons also in the movie? It'll be all the Hollywood Jeremys.
I wish we had Jeremy Irons in the movie, but we do not. I am so impressed with a few things about this movie. Number one, I'll just say the performances, because both Jeremy Allen White and Jeremy Strong and Jeremy Irons, all three of them are spectacular in their appearances here or not appearing in the movie. So I think Jeremy Strong may be one of our greats. I am impressed every time I see this man take on a persona. He has like this character actor thing where he just becomes another person. Now, I know there's plenty of, or I understand, even though I haven't, kind of really looked at it, that there's a lot of, behind the scenes stuff that, you know, his acting compatriots will talk about him being, you know, what's that called? What DDL, you know, the when you act the person the entire time, it's just slipping method? Method acting, like his method acting, those kind of things are apparently very annoying. And I can imagine that is true, but man, does it seem to work on screen for me. So I really like the performances. I really felt like I learned something about Springsteen watching this. It focuses on a very specific time in his life where he wants to put out his folk album before he puts out his next pop album, and just how the studio is basically like, what are you doing? You have Born in the USA waiting to release. This is going to be the biggest hit of all time, and you know, you're waiting on it. So yeah, there's just a lot of interesting stuff there with the story that I felt like I learned about. Couple other interesting quirky performances. David Krumholz plays one of the label people. I think he's always great when I see Krumholz pop up in something. And then this marked the third movie in a row without trying that I saw that had Paul Walter Hauser in it. I mean, I think the guy is just in everything this year. Like it's insane. So yeah, he's in this as well.
He's the new Willem Dafoe.
He is. I think he put that on his business cards. I also have discovered after really enjoying this that I'm in the minority. Apparently a lot of people feel like this is a Dewey Cox story, that it is so, you know, because there's a lot of, you know, black and white childhood stuff with an abusive father and like all this stuff. And, you know, somebody says the wrong kid died. No, nobody says that. But but it feels like that. Right. And I can see that how when you're looking for those tropes, I guess my answer to that is I guess I like the tropes. I don't know. I guess they work on me. I guess the cliches work on me. So yeah, cause I had a really good time, was very moved by some of the messages about getting help, therapy, depression, anxiety, like going through that stuff and figuring out, you know, how Springsteen had to figure out what this anxiety inside him was and then to get help with it. Yeah, I found it very interesting.
He sounds in the trailer, he sounds exactly like Springsteen when he's singing.
He's
like,
really good. Yeah, he's very good.
I don't know
good.
How you do that, because he even said in a behind-the-scenes video I watched, he hasn't had any formal singing training. He's never been a singer. And he just, how does an actor do that? It blows my mind. I'm very interested, especially for the mental health angles.
Yeah, it's a testament to how much I like Jeremy Allen White and Jeremy Strong that I want to see this, because I've never been a Springsteen guy. I would say I've enjoyed a couple of songs that I've heard over the years, but most of the time I hear something and it's like, why is everybody into this? Is basically what I think when I'm listening to Springsteen a lot of times. And I ultimately get it. It's just, it's not my type of thing. But, I think one of the things that this movie had going against it already was the fact that they were going to focus solely basically on him making this album Nebraska that is very critically acclaimed, but hardly anybody has or owns or loves or whatever. Like, it's one of those type of albums, like one of those that I probably won a ton of Grammys, but you ask the John, you know, like a normal person out on the street, have you ever heard that Nebraska album? Most people haven't. So that's one thing that turned people off. I'm going to watch this at some point. I don't know if I'm going to watch it in theaters, but I definitely want to see it for the performances and everything. So,
And I did mention Stephen Graham, who's having a great time recently, is in this as well, that plays the abusive father in the black and white flashbacks.
Mm-hmm. Did you mention Jeremy Irons?
Jeremy Irons, just absolutely fabulous in his complete absence from the movie.
Jeremy London's also in the movie.
Yeah, Jeremy London as well.
Pearl Jam sings Jeremy at one point. It's pretty impressive stuff. But yeah, I found all that stuff about Nebraska very interesting. There's this whole subplot about how he didn't intend on releasing his demo tapes. He just went into a hotel room, recorded a bunch of stuff on a little four-track cassette recorder, on like four-track cassette. And then he couldn't get it out of his head that this is how it was supposed to sound. And there's this whole section where Mark Maron, who plays like a producer, audio, you know, technical producer guy, is trying to match this like downgraded cassette sound to his like high tech, you know, tracks or whatever, and it's driving him crazy. But Springsteen was like, no, that sounds too polished, too professional. You know, yeah. It's like, we're not releasing the demos, but make it sound like the demos. Anyways,
that reminds me of a thing. Was it? It was the Sex Pistols, maybe. They had this quick career, and I guess they continued playing music, not as the Sex Pistols, and then they came back much later for like a reunion tour or whatever. And they all realized that they had one big problem. They were now too good at the instruments they were playing, and they had to like dumb it down a little bit because they needed to play it that raw sound again.
Amazing.
I think that's a very interesting thing to delve into, by
yep.
the way. Just people kind of prefer the crackly, less polished versions of stuff.
Then you have like Smashing Pumpkins where Billy Corgan will play like the same guitar part like 1,000 times and layer it on top of itself.
Oh yeah.
Everybody's different in the way they want their music to sound, I guess.
True. Jeremy, what do you got?
I had the absolute pleasure of watching 75 on Rotten Tomatoes, not inventing anything new, action movie, Fight or Flight with Josh Hartnett.
Mm.
This was on one of the movie channels. It's not HBO, but...
Prime, maybe?
It's what?
Prime? Is it Prime?
When I went to that website that tells you where you can watch it, this morning it said this is not available for free anywhere.
Maybe
it must be like MGM or Showtime or something like that. This is basically Bullet Train on a plane. Josh Hartnett is a former Secret Service agent hiding out in Bangkok, wherever that is, Thailand. And he gets a call that he's the only person anywhere close to the Bangkok airport who can escort this infamous hacker Ghost to the United States on this flight. And so he's talked into taking this gig, but he doesn't know what Ghost looks like. Mm. And then once he gets on the plane and it's in the air, he finds out basically every other person on the plane is an assassin who's been sent to kill Ghost. And so he has to now protect Ghost by doing all these fight scenes. Now, listen, in some of these scenes, he's drunk. In some of these scenes, he's been drugged. In one of these fight scenes, he downs what he thinks is an adrenaline shot, but it actually ends up being snake venom. And no one has ever had more fun making a movie than Josh Hartnett is having making this movie. And that is why I had a blast. He is so much fun. The way he acts in different states of inebriation, the expressions he makes on his face. There are a couple of exasperated expressions I've never seen anyone make that just made me laugh out loud. It is in no way anything you haven't seen before other than Josh Hartnett having this much fun. I can't recommend it enough if you can find it. I was giggling the whole time.
I really enjoy this new stage of Josh Hartnett that has been in the last 5 years or so. When he first came up, I wasn't a huge fan of him at all. I don't think I liked him at all. And I think everything he was in was maybe just too serious or just too, it seemed like he was too full of himself or something. And maybe it was my own bias. Maybe it was what I was going through at the time. I don't know. Anyway, the Josh Hartnett of today is in movies like Trap, which I don't like, but I think is really, he's really fun in it and everything. And he has that, I like the fact that he's an Oppenheimer of all. I mean, like that was not expecting that at all.
Yeah.
Whatever, but he's been in some really fun stuff, and I want to see this now, especially after you've described what his performance is like in this. So, I'm down for this new Josh Hartnett that's happened over the last few years.
Yeah, Jeremy. I mean, you stole my joke from my review when I saw this, which is they should have called it Bullet Plane, because it really is very, very similar to that. It's just I would call this movie dumb fun. You know, like it's not, you're not going to come away from it going, oh, the thematic resonance of this scene, you know, really ties into the larger cultural landscape and what we're going through. Like, it is guy on plane in a closed environment has to avoid being killed by every single person in this closed environment. And it is fun the way they do that. I think there's one of the opening action scenes is in a bathroom, a plane bathroom. That I've never seen a bathroom on a plane like this. I need to travel on planes like this that have bathrooms this big.
It was a luxury bathroom.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it was crazy. But the absolute there's a little bit of upgrade to his performance in this, in that, like, when he's drugged or drunk or whatever, like, he's almost like amazed that he's, you know, killing these people or doing the things that he's doing. It's just it's a really fun way to do this. So yeah, there's a lot of fun to be had, and that's about all you're going to get out of it is a lot of fun. So yeah.
All right, let's move on to our big recommend, which is Picnic at Hanging Rock, 1975 Peter Weir film. It is my turn this week, so I will take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Picnic at Hanging Rock is Peter Weir's second feature film. It's written by Cliff Green, based on the novel by Joan Lindsay. It begins with text that tells us that the year is 1900 and some schoolgirls who picnicked at Hanging Rock disappeared. A girl's voice narrates, "What we see and what we seem are but a dream within a dream." Cue Zamfir's pan flute. It's Valentine's Day at Apple Yard College, a girl's school where everyone is reading the poetry from their Valentine's cards and counting how many they got. As one of the girls, Miranda, played by Anne Louise Lambert, combs her hair, she invites her friend Sarah, played by Margaret Nelson, to her family's house, an invitation that Sarah enthusiastically agrees to. But Miranda cautions Sarah that she must learn to love another person than her because she won't be around much longer. Why does she think that? Shortly after, we find out that the picnic at Hanging Rock is happening today and that Sarah is being held back from it. Outside, the schoolmaster, Mrs. Appleyard, played by Rachel Roberts, reminds the girls that the rock itself is dangerous, and they are therefore forbidden in any tomboy foolishness in the matter of exploration, even on the lowest slopes. Oh, and also, there are snakes and poisonous ants. Fucking Australia, man. Also, they'll have to write an essay about it, so this trip sounds less and less fun the more you hear about it. Everyone gets on the horse-drawn carriage that seats 20 comfortably. We get a geological discussion about the rock, with the driver of the carriage spouting out facts that the teacher, Miss McCraw, played by Vivian Gray, occasionally has to correct. It's a volcanic rock that erupted a million years ago. Quite a recent eruption, as it turns out, as the entire area is 350 million years old. There's another party at the rock, a colonel and his wife, along with their nephew, Michael, played by Dominic Guard, and his buddy, Albert, played by John Jarrett. Michael and Albert enjoy a little alcohol out in the woods and out of sight from their elders. Back at the school, Sarah is forced to sit through lessons about posture and poetry, asking for a memorized recitation of one of her favorite poets. Sarah tries to pass one of her own poems as worthy of saying aloud, but is instantly interrupted by the principal, who likes what she likes, and children ain't it. Appleyard tells Sarah she must memorize and recite the poem by the time she summons her teacher to the classroom. After Appleyard leaves, Sarah calls out her brother Bertie's name and her friend Miranda, wishing they could be with her. Back at Hanging Rock, we find out everyone's watches have stopped at noon, which could be troublesome in trying to gauge what time to go back. Four of the girls, including Margaret, Irma, played by Karen Robson, Edith, played by Christine Schuler, and Marion, played by Jane Vallis, decide they want to explore the other parts of the rock, and they leave the others behind. As Margaret waves goodbye, Mademoiselle de Poitiers, played by Helen Morse, seeing a picture of Venus in a book, remarks that she finally knows what Margaret is, a Botticelli angel. At a creek, they distantly pass by Arthur and Michael, where even in remote Australia, they have to endure Arthur's wolf whistles from afar. Michael, who doesn't care much for his antics, nonetheless is the one who follows the girls after they cross the creek. Eventually, the four girls reach a spot where they are in full exploration mode around the rock they were told was dangerous and shouldn't explore, walking through the tiny crevices leading to the top. At one point, Edith, the one who most wants to go back, wakes up and sees her three companions walk off into another section of the rock without their shoes, and she follows. From this vantage point, they can see the rest of their classmates down below. Not long after, they all fall asleep near the very top of the rock. Once again, Edith wakes up to see the other three walking to yet another level of the rock, this time with her protesting and screaming not to go any further, and we don't see it either. Back at the school, Mrs. Appleyard calls for one of her staff, Minnie, to come down. Minnie is played by possibly the only super recognizable actor in this movie, Jackie Weaver. Cut to a clock that says it's 10:30 now, well past the 8 p.m. return time. The carriage does eventually return, but it's sitting 16 far more comfortably now. Everyone is sobbing, and the only news that comes out immediately is that they left Miss McCraw behind. Sarah comes out to greet them, but very much notices Margaret isn't with them. The carriage driver tells Appleyard that three girls and the teacher are now missing. When asked what happened, he says, "That's just the trouble. No one knows what happened. The only thing anyone really knows is that Edith came back to the main picnic site screaming with her dress torn." The next scene involves a search party at Hanging Rock, complete with dogs and a whole lot of noise in case the girls hear it. Edith is questioned by a cop, played by Wynn Roberts, and by DePoitiers. They ask her what scared her so much before she ran away. She doesn't seem to have an answer. They ask if she saw a man, but she doesn't say. The doctor tells Appleyard that the scratches on her legs probably came from the brambles and that there isn't any sign of sexual assault. He uses the term quite intact as if he is not only relieved that an assault didn't happen, but the girl is a virgin, thank God. The police ask Michael what he saw. He claims he merely saw them at the creek and that he only saw three. Then he describes four girls. He also doesn't mention the part where he started following them. They take Edith back to Hanging Rock to try to recreate the scene, but she doesn't remember everything and she gets tired. All she can remember is that when she came down, she saw a red cloud as she passed Miss McCraw, who was going up the hill as Edith went down, but she was too far away to see Edith. But Edith saw that Miss McCraw had no skirt on, wearing merely pantaloons on her legs. A bloodhound is unable to find anyone. Also, Michael's buddy Arthur must have narked on him because the police go back and ask why he didn't tell them he followed the girls. Mm-hmm. He now claims he followed them for a bit, but then turned back. The cop asks Michael what he was thinking when he saw the girls jumping the creek, and that makes him nervous because for a teenage boy's horniness is an extremely difficult thing to hide. Mm-hmm. We then get taken to a party of some sort where Michael tells Arthur that he wakes up in cold sweats every night, wondering if the girls are still alive. Michael even asks Arthur if he wants to come with him and search for the girls. Arthur claims he is content living his life not knowing and not searching, but he does eventually join his buddy. Michael searches, leaving a literal paper trail wherever he goes. A day passes and there's no luck. Michael decides he's going to make camp while Arthur goes back to tell Michael's uncle a lie about where he is. The next day, Michael searches further, and then he starts sleeping, and the movie leaves open the interpretation he is remembering dialogue from the movie that he himself could not have heard. It's a weird section, but the mystical properties of the rock might make it possible. Arthur returns to find Michael in bad shape and calls what amounts to a cavalry to get him help. Michael, before being whisked away, hands Arthur a torn piece of dress that he found, which leads to Arthur now becoming way more interested in the search. He goes to the rock alone, and he finds Irma looking badly injured and dazed. Eventually, news of Irma being found hits the small town around Appleyard. While everyone seems happy about the Irma news, Appleyard is more concerned about the business. Three sets of parents have already told her that their kids won't be attending next year. And now the fact that only one of the girls have been found is going to bring more bad publicity. The three girls who won't be attending, plus the three girls who went missing, plus the outstanding dues from girls like Sarah, are going to be devastating for her bottom line. Irma seems to have mostly injuries around her hands. Her head has a bruise, which leads to speculation as to whether she got struck in the head or fell. But if she fell, why is nothing else on her body bruised? And her feet, even though she wasn't wearing shoes, are completely fine. One of the nurses notes that Irma's clothes did not include a corset. Two gardeners at a greenhouse have a discussion about whether they'll at long last have answers. The younger one speculates, while the older one accepts that there may not be answers to the questions they have. The older man distracts the younger guy with a demonstration that some plants can move. but it may serve only to bring up more unanswered questions. Appleyard tells Sarah that her guardian hasn't been paying the bills, which will lead to her being unable to do the fun stuff at the school. If she doesn't get payment by Easter, she'll have to leave. This forces her into a depression. She tells Minnie about the abuse she suffered at an orphanage where she was adopted separately from her brother Bertie. Minnie tells the guy she's banging that she feels sorry for those kids. He thinks she means the girls who went missing, but she tells him that she feels sorry mostly for all these girls at the school who have been through tough times, even without a gone missing story. De Poitiers visits Irma, who tells her that she can't remember anything. When she visits Sarah, she seems to be preparing for Miranda's return, but when she asks Sarah if she realizes she might never come back, Sarah tells De Poitiers that Miranda seemed to know things that others didn't. She recalls the words Miranda said about not being around much longer. Irma, decked out in a striking red cape, visits a dance class with De Poitiers telling them she's about to leave the school for good. But the girls there don't seem to care about much other than asking her what happened, because she has to know. They surround her and berate her for not telling them. There may or may not be a lesson about human nature here. One thing I am sure of is that the teacher playing piano for the dancing girls really does seem to enjoy the abuse. And when you realize this, almost like a sick joke with a nauseating punchline, De Poitiers notices that the teacher has strapped Sarah to a wall standing upright to fix her posture or some nonsense. In the very next scene, that teacher turns in her notice. The principal, already worrying about the finances, thinks this is a good time for a drink. Also, it's as good a time as any to tell Sarah that she's sending her back to the orphanage. Michael talks about how he's still haunted by what happened at the Rock, and then Albert tells Michael of a dream about his kid sister that he used to know at the orphanage, and we now know Albert is the Bertie that Sarah has been referring to. The principal and De Poitiers have a private dinner together where Appleyard now seems more pissed about Miss McCraw getting herself killed because of how much she came to rely on her, and oh, also misses her masculine intellect. The old man in the greenhouse, at first disgusted with the mess the kids have made around his domain, discovers a broken window in the ceiling, which leads to the discovery that Sarah jumped from the school and took her own life. Through some sort of future narrator, we find out Mrs. Appleyard was found dead at Hanging Rock shortly after, and the other girls who were missing still haven't been found. With that note, guys, what did you think of Picnic at Hanging Rock?
I would like to read for you a note I wrote 10 minutes into this movie. I'm going to read it verbatim. They have mentioned snakes so many times in the first 10 minutes. I have no doubt snakes are going to show up at some point in this movie and bite some people. That never happens, obviously. But listen,
or didn't does it, Jeremy? It? Didn't it?
Or does it?
I have plenty of good things to say about this movie. Visually, one of the most interesting movies I've seen in the last several years. I think it is very interesting to look at. I also made a note that it reminded me of Terrence Malick films in a lot of ways. I think the performances, the etherealness of it all, is really fantastically done. I personally could have done with one or two answers. and ultimately, the movie, I don't think, is about Hanging Rock anywhere near as much as it's about the life of these girls in this school and how oppressive that situation is for girls who had only come here from other oppressive situations or bad situations. And I think when I watch this movie again, which I will 100% be doing, with that in mind, I think I'm going to discover even more to take away from it. I don't really have negative things to say. It's just that I was expecting some kind of answers, some kind of explanation, some kind of, like, the Rock... Like why? Here's another note that I love that I wanted to make sure I read. What's with the swan? Did it mean something? Did it drown? Did it dive and swim dozens of feet away and out of sight? Did it dive and drown? Why? Where, swan? That was my note. There are a lot of like interesting threads here that the movie throws out, and it's not super interested in tying them all together, and that's okay. I even wrote at some point, I think this movie is mostly just vibes, and that's okay too. I like plenty of movies that are just vibes. I think what my experience was colored by was going into it, the title, Picnic at Hanging Rock, an incident happens at this Hanging Rock, and then it's just, it's not interested in telling you what actually happened. And I, not knowing that going in, it was a frustrating end for me, but I think if I knew that going in, I could appreciate it. It's kind of like Anatomy of a Fall isn't interested in telling you what happened as much as it is. It wants you to make up your own mind what happened. And this movie leaves a lot of that up to the viewer. But I was in it, man, all the way through. It hooked me, and I was pretty mesmerized watching this movie. And only when no snakes showed up, and then the answers were still missing, I started to be like, "Oh, this wasn't as what I expected it to be." But also, she knew that Sarah was going to kill herself, right? That old lady, like,
I don't know if she knew that. I know that she probably would have preferred that not happen on the grounds, considering her business sense and everything. I don't think so. I think she's just cruel to children in general, and I don't think she cares one way or another what happens to them afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so, all
right.
You are, by the way, you are exactly like one of the people that watched this movie when Peter Weir was taking this to the States to get distribution. Apparently, one of the potential buyers was drinking some coffee and like spit, like threw it through the coffee or whatever at the screen or something, and said, "Oh, I sat through the whole 2 hours waiting for answers for that, and I didn't get one of them. I didn't get one answer."
I didn't throw anything at the screen. and I figured out at some point that we weren't going to get answers before the end. But yeah, I need to watch it a few more times to really kind of put my head around it and figure out what I think it's trying to say or what I think it says to me. I had a really good time watching it. So, Aaron, what do you think?
Jeremy, are you telling me everybody got the answers but you?
Yes, apparently.
I have very similar feelings. I didn't necessarily love the process of watching this, but I will tell you, I have loved the process of thinking about it. And I think that speaks to something that's really well done here. My very first note is, if this isn't one of Sofia Coppola's favorite movies, I'll eat my pretty white gloves and hat.
IMDb says it is.
Okay. It feels proto-Sofia Coppola in so many ways.
She says it was a direct influence on The Virgin Suicides and Marie Antoinette.
So, that was my very first note about it. The lack of answers, it's not something that I dwell on, because I don't think the movie is necessarily about what happens. It's about the atmosphere that leads to them disappearing, right? So the movie to me, and I think you touched on this, Jeremy, really feels like it's about what is hidden, what is repressed, what is, you know, not allowed to breathe oxygen, you know? There are so many scenes in this movie that indicate it is about what repression does to the need to escape, right? Mm. And so there's an escape that happens. We don't know how that escape happens. We don't know if it's death or running away or, something traumatic and tragic, you know, abuse or whatever. But repression leads to these things. I'll just name a few that stood out to me while I was watching. The boys are talking about watching them, you know, cross the river, and you know, he says something silly like, "I bet they've got legs under there that leads up to their bums."
Yeah,
you know, and this for that era was, you know, scandalous that they're, that, you know, biologically their legs might lead to their rear ends. But just that he said that out loud, the other guy says something like, I wish you wouldn't say crude things. And then he responds, I say the crude things, you just think them. Yeah. And that is kind of what this movie is doing in some ways. It's about the difference between giving oxygen to that, to hear it, to understand it, to, you know, process it versus keeping it down. I think many times culturally we confuse repression for a decorum. We think we're teaching decorum, which is this idea of there's context for what you say, when you say it, how you say things. There are times when it's okay to talk about these things, and there are times when you probably shouldn't be saying these things or doing these things. That's decorum, but we instead repress, which that is an outside influence in that says you can't think these things, you can't be these things. And so it sends the message that you are wrong as a person. You're a bad person because you have these thoughts or want to do these things.
You're giving me my childhood all over again, Aaron.
Well, I think this movie is speaking very deeply about these things in different ways. And so decorum is inside out. It's, oh, I have these things. I know it doesn't make me a bad person. But contextually, now's not the time to express them, or now's not the time to talk about them. Now's not the time to do this thing. So I think understanding that is understanding what this movie is saying about these girls and what they're going through. Another very specific moment is the taking off of the gloves once they get past town. Just this simple little thing of having hand coverings. She says something before they go, like, it's a hot enough day that once you've passed a certain point, I'll let you take off your gloves, mm-hmm. you know? And the exhilaration in these women's faces, these young women's faces, when they can just take that fabric off their arms and hands.
Well,
and
even later, they go without shoes, and then there's a whole stockings. Thing where they're taking off their stockings.
Yep. Yeah, all of that, again, is escaping that repression in the slightest, you know, little ways. And I think the movie, even in its larger plot mechanics about what happened to these girls, is speaking to those things. The mystery of what happened to them is the mystery of the unexplored. It is the mystery of, you know, what happens when we just shut ourselves off from those things. So, I really thought a lot about this movie afterwards, even if during the movie it didn't quite engage, like some of the performances didn't quite engage me, you know, like I found my brain wandering. I think it's the tone, not the tone, the pacing is not my favorite. You mentioned Malick. I think that's a great mention. I'm not generally a huge Malick fan because of the same reason. Like, it just doesn't, that kind of tone poem doesn't necessarily engage me in the same way. But man, I haven't stopped thinking about it. There's one quote, and I wrote it down because I loved it so much. I think they're looking down on the people, and they say, a surprising number of human beings are without purpose.
Yeah.
Though it is probable that they are performing some function unknown even to themselves. I think that is so good, because how many times do I look around at the world and just go, is anybody examining their life? Like, you know, is anybody taking stock of the things going on around them? Are you thinking about why you're here, what you exist for, how are you making the world a better place? Are you thinking about these things? And it feels like nobody is, and yet people do fulfill purposes even in their unknowing. I thought this is a really beautiful movie, and Peter Weir is clearly talented and knew how to bring all this stuff to light. So I think overall, even though it's not like a great watch for me, it's a great movie to have seen, because I really think it's going to stick with me in a lot of ways.
And isn't that the mark of a movie that you will enjoy in the next 10 to 15 years?
Yes.
And probably are going to recommend to others later on down the line. I'm glad that this movie doesn't have answers. I think it does tell you that there's something kind of mystical going on out here. I think it at least hints enough at that to tell you that there's something we can't explain going on here. In the chat, Lolly, who is definitely a big fan of this movie, wrote something about, we're talking about, English colonialism and everything, and like how you have these people who don't really kind of belong in this ancient place, bringing their own beliefs and works to the rock, and this rock this place does not accept them in any way. So there's probably going to be some punishment for not giving this place its proper due and everything like that. I think it does have something to do with that, is that these are people who don't belong and they don't realize their own place here when they're wandering around on this place. But I like the fact that there's no answers, because and this is one of the things that I saw in the interview with Peter Weir on this, but it's like, if you did explain what happened to them, it's almost always going to be disappointing. The real mystery of what happened to them is something that you're always going to be fascinated by. But once you, it's like the Christian Bale says in The Prestige, once I tell you the trick, you're going to not be impressed anymore. And, to me, if you found out that aliens abducted them, would that be satisfying? Or that they fell in a hole, which was another one that was kind of like speculated on or whatever. I guess for some of us it would. Like, oh, okay, so they fell down a hole. But then why did we make this whole movie about it at that point? And to me, the answers this movie's looking for is what happens to all the people after this incident happens. What gets exposed based on what happens when they go to this rock. We find out, that this starts to break people down, and it starts bringing out the worst and the best out of certain people and whatever. And so I like the fact that, the movie is more focused on how do people react to this than what happened to them. That to me is the more important thing about what happens in this movie. So
I think the answers are all there. It's a cult of wallabies, sentient wallabies that kidnap humans because they are secretly aliens, and they are sending these humans to their home planet. All the clues are right there.
I think it was the snakes.
yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's like there was a point in there where the colonel's wife is telling her nephew, and he's like, "Watch out! There may be snakes or something like that." And I was like, "That's Australia's tour guide slogan right there. They might be snakes."
He said venomous snakes so many times that when we see that couple picnicking, I'm like, "Why the fuck would you picnic here if it's that deadly?"
It's kind of like, in The Perfect Getaway, where they're like, "We're gonna need machetes," and they don't need the machetes. Like, if you're gonna tell us that, hey, there were ants though, you gotta admit there were ants all over the place.
And lots of flies. Lots of flies.
Yeah, lots of flies. And that one dog, I was like, man, wipe all the flies out of that dog's face. Seriously. Come on. Come on. He's trying to get you answers, and you're just letting flies go all over his face.
Meanwhile, anyway. Jeremy is watching The Visions and just going, "Stop staring at me, Swan." And that's all he took from that. So.
See, I personally had one hypothesis at one point that those girls became swans.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So... whatever, pick whatever you want on that. I agree. The movie is a slow kind of, it's a very slow burn. It's never, ever, it never, ever ignites either. It's this way the entire time. I think the first time I ever watched it, I was like, man, why does everybody talk about this movie? And then the second time I watched it, I liked it a lot better. I think the third time now that I've seen this, I really love this movie. But it's also not the type of movie that you're like, I must watch this again immediately or anything like that. You're going to have to let this sit with you for a while, probably before you watch it again. So I'm not surprised at the reactions to this one at all. It's clearly a movie that requires that kind of like build and whatever. And for some people, That was their one try, and they'll never have another one. But it's a shame, because I think you'll really get more out of it the more you watch it. Let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
What do you guys got?
Go.
In this case, I think you'd be safe going, not because that you might steal my abstract double feature, but because I picked the most obvious one ever that I doubt you would pick, which has already been mentioned, the Virgin Suicides. I think, like, I'm watching this going, am I watching the Virgin Suicides again? Like, mm-hmm. it feels so much like those sisters, five sisters, right?
I think so.
I think one of them commits suicide, and then the others make an apparent suicide pact. And it deals with the same issues about repression and
absolutely
the reasons they're trying to escape.
And it's got Josh Hartnett in it.
And we mentioned Josh Hartnett. So it all comes together. But yeah, I think they're a perfect 1-2 punch.
I very nearly, for the sake of funds, went with and for my buddy Aaron, I almost went with Old from In My Shyamalan. But I hate that movie so much I can't. What's funny is that she says that this movie directly influenced Virgin Suicides and Marie Antoinette. And I certainly had the Virgin Suicides on my list, but my double feature is The Beguiled from
Sophie Coppola. The Beguiled,
which is another all-girls school dealing with the same kind of issues of the repression and the lack of knowledge of the outside world, because this wounded soldier comes in and they take care of him, and like all of their hormones are awakened. I think it would vibe very well. I think any of Sofia Coppola's movies would pair well with Picnic and Hanging Rock, but I went with Beguiled.
Not that it matters, but which Beguiled?
The Sofia Coppola one. I've seen both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But and
it makes sense.
They would both be a good pair, but anyway.
I did have a couple others in the chamber just in case. Both aren't full connections, but have interesting like subconnections. One was Weapons, because of like the concept, you know, just
people disappearing.
People disappeared. What happened? Now Weapons has many more answers, like very specific answers in Weapons. And then the other one I thought of, which is an even more abstract connection, is I saw the TV glow. I don't know if you saw that one, but it deals with a lot of the same, like escaping and trying to, you know, find who you are and this escaping to nothingness, and has a really interesting ending as well. So
yeah, it does.
So yeah, I saw the TV glow came to mind as well.
That movie's bonkers. I liked it.
I need to watch it again. I wasn't, I didn't like it as much as everybody else seemed to like it. I know that when I saw the trailer for it, I was really excited about it. And then it didn't, I guess, live up to what I thought it was in my mind, but I definitely want to see that movie again. I think if one of you had picked Picnic at Hanging Rock, I would have ended up on the Virgin Suicides. But I also can't help but think that this is so close to a lot of the things that happen in Dead Poets Society, which is another big Peter Weir movie.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the same
things. Yeah, there's so many different things in there where, you know, that's an all-boys school, and, you know, they go off into the cave and they read poetry and they become, that's their freedom.
Yeah.
And then when they aren't allowed to be free, that's when one of them, you know, gets into a, you know, a quandary with his life and everything. But, I was sitting there going, I know he had to have gone back to his Picnic at Hanging Rock days to make Dead Poets Society. There's so many parallels.
Sure.
And everything. Yeah,
that's good.
And having recently watched Fearless, which is another Peter Weir movie, like even Fearless has some sort of, it's not the same, and these are not close to the same movies, but Fearless has a lot of that like unknowable type of thing going on. If you've never seen it, Jeff Bridges survives a plane crash and he was a hero to a bunch of people to help them off the plane. and he once was very scared of things in life, and now he approaches everything like he can't die, and nothing about the movie really says nothing explains why is he suddenly fearless, like why is he like this or anything, and they don't really ponder what happened on the plane all that much. It's just about what happens to him afterwards and everything, and I really enjoyed that one too as a possible Peter Weir connection. Anyway, all right, what is next week's homework? I believe it's Jeremy's turn. So, Jeremy, what are we going to be watching for next week?
We are going to be watching my favorite movie of 2024. It's on HBO without the Max. It's Civil War from Alex Garland, and it's got some good acting and some themes that will probably feel familiar to you if you read the news. But don't be scared of the movie. The movie is not as interested in what causes a civil war as it
is. I want answers to that, Jeremy. Why did they start civil warring?
As it is about the journalists who cover the war and their experiences as they try and go to interview the president. I adore this movie. I cannot stop watching it. It speaks to me on a spiritual level. And I cannot wait to dive into it with you guys and the chat next week.
I am looking forward to seeing this again. I think I've now watched this movie 6 or 7 times, mainly because I was on the send script for this. And it was one of those movies that I was like, I'm going to have to watch this several times before I get into the headspace of like writing sends for it. I really want to watch it without that kind of baggage and everything. I watched it in theaters and I liked it okay. Liked it better during the sins process. Now I get to watch it just for fun, and I want to want to see this without any other kind of baggage around it and everything. This is a beautiful, beautifully shot movie, and a lot of like very like I can't wait to talk about certain scenes with you guys on this one. Okay, that's going to do it for this week. Chat, once again, thank you so much for coming out. Appreciate your discussion about this movie, even if you hated it or you loved it. It looks like it's, you know, you don't have really, I guess you guys were kind of ambivalent. You guys were kind of down the middle on this or whatever. So maybe there's just a hodgepodge of reactions to that. But anyway, thank you, chat, for coming out. We appreciate you very much. That's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. Watching both at the same time. The Chiefs and Commanders at halftime, 7-7. And a blurb comes up on the ESPN thing that says, Chiefs are, it's some ungodly record when they score first. And I was sitting there just going, what is this for? Like, I don't know if this is just like a thing to encourage betting or it could be something like that. But like I've seen even before ESPN was in the betting game, which I have a lot of thoughts about that. But even before they were in the betting game, they would put up blurbs like this. And I was like, okay, so in a tie game at halftime, what does the scoring first give them here? Does it matter that they were the ones who scored first? In a 7-7 game, can you tell me what the through line is here that makes this a meaningful stat? And I also, if you look at the Chiefs over the years, you may have recognized that for the last, oh, 7-8 years. They've been a good team. They've gone to the Super Bowl number of times. And so, like, I bet their record with teams, other teams scoring first, their opponents scoring first, is pretty good,
too. It's also pretty good, yeah.
And so, like, I don't know what you're scrounging here. I had a brief discussion about this with Jeremy last night. I was just like, I just don't know what you're, and we came to the conclusion that there is like, hey, we're doing something. We looked something up or whatever. Look at us. We came up with a record and a thing and put it up on the screen. Look at us. But man, I really wonder how many people looked at that stat and said, wow, oh, okay. Well, they'll probably win this game then. And you know, they scored first. It's a tie game. I don't know where you're, I just don't know where, what the stat does for me. Part of the reason why I don't watch 24-hour news networks anymore, it's been a long time now that I don't watch them. I remember being enraptured and glued to the Malaysia flight that went down. I was actually in the hospital while that was going on. I had some unknown thing going on with me. And like every morning I would wake up and like, I wonder if they figured out anything about that Malaysia flight. And like every morning I was in the hospital for like 4 or 5 days. Every morning I was looking at it and it was like they had one brand new nugget of information, but really everything else was just speculation. And after you watch 5 days of that and people don't really know anything, all they know is here's a couple of things. The only way we're really going to know what happened is if we miraculously find this wreckage in the giant ocean that it crashed into. Then there's no point in sitting there and watching all this speculation by people who don't know either, you know. So
if you had told me, even in college, that it was possible for an airplane to completely disappear and no one ever find it, I would have laughed in your face. I would have said, that's not possible, you ignoramus, because college Jeremy did not understand.
You were mean in college.
That's right.
Did I tell you my new favorite science fact? So for a long time, my favorite science fact was from Neil deGrasse Tyson's talk that we went to at TPAC, where he said, if you shrunk the Earth down to the size of a cue ball, it would be smoother than a cue ball. And that blew my mind. And then a couple of years ago, I learned that there have been sharks on Earth for longer than Saturn has had rings. And that became my new favorite mind blow. So now, last week, I learned a new one. There are multiple rivers in the Appalachian Mountains that are older than the Atlantic Ocean.
Whoa.
That blows my mind. The continents even separated enough to create an Atlantic Ocean, these bodies of water existed. That's wild to me.
It's amazing. But did you know a human head weighs 8 pounds?
There's this traveling found footage troupe that goes around. They're called Everything is Terrible. And I've seen them at Belcourt. This was like probably 12, 13 years ago or so. And they come in and they've either found these tapes or people have donated these tapes to them, and you see like these wild stuff for, like, from the 80s and whatever, that people like the long forgotten media type stuff. But also, I don't know how this all started, they are collecting Jerry Maguire tapes. So they have all these Jerry Maguire video cassettes, and they have even created their own store.
Okay, I read about this.
I think it's like thousands of Jerry Maguire tapes that they have, and I think their ultimate goal, from what I read on the website, was that they want to create a pyramid of Jerry Maguire tapes in the desert or something like that. I don't know why Jerry Maguire, but it's so funny.
We will build a tower of Maguire that will reach God himself.
Exactly. Correct.
I feel like Jay Moore has had a really interesting career, because roundabout Jerry Maguire and then that Jennifer Aniston rom-com he did in the mid-90s, it felt like he was going to explode. And then he kind of became a sports commentator.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a. He was a stand-up comic. He was in with Suicide Kings or something like that. I think because yeah. yeah. he's got his own Christopher Walken from that. I think he's another Christopher Walken impersonator guy. Mm. And he was in Go, and then he had that show Action that everybody loved, but it didn't last very long. It was one of the first shows that would bleep swears and stuff on network TV or whatever, and people loved the show. The five people that watched it. It wasn't one of those that, you know, that took off. But yeah, I agree. I thought Jay Moore was going to take off too. I thought he was going to be a.
I guess the most recent thing he's been in of note was Air, right? Because other than that.
Oh, he was in Air. I forgot that.
And didn't he marry the Clippers owner or the Clippers owner's daughter or something like that?
Oh, that's good. It's a good way to get courtside seats.
It is a good way. Yeah. No, he's married to Jeannie Buss.
Yes,
he divorced Nikki Cox.
Yes, I hadn't gotten to that part of the paragraph yet, but he did take her name two years after they married.
I see. That's the Lakers, not the Clippers.
Jeannie Buss.
Yeah, that is the Lakers. Jerry Buss was the longtime owner of the Lakers that John C. Reilly played in.
So then. I'm guessing this means Jay Moore has LeBron James's cell phone number on his phone, right?
Easily.
Can call that dude anytime he wants. And he's like,
anytime.
You're not playing well enough. I'm sleeping with the boss. She's, you know, been telling me you need to step up, old man.
Right. Yeah, he does that constantly.
How big is the NBA gambling scandal, do you think?
I think it's bigger than we know yet.
Do you think we'll find out? Do you think they'll shut it down and we won't know?
Did you see that clip of them trying to talk about it on a talking head sports show, but they had to like censor their own on-screen crawl because it was like telling you to call DraftKings and bet right now or something like that?
Yep, they had a regularly scheduled DraftKings ad to have a little thing on the right corner or whatever, and then they're sitting there talking about gambling scandals. Quickly went off.
Oh, the hypocrisy. Oh, it's amazing. Yeah,
they're probably really bad and probably in all sports.
Yeah, we're going to find out a lot of sports.
Well, we had that thing with the pitchers in Cleveland this year who were like tipping their first pitch on certain games. Like two pitchers got suspended indefinitely from Cleveland for basically helping gamblers.
I mean, a lot of it is that they're all these stupid prop bets, right? Like, there's just these stupid bets that mean nothing to who wins and loses the game and that people can manipulate and tell other people they're going to manipulate. Like, that's the, you know, that's a lot of the crux of it. Like, you know.
I mean, if you could only bet on who won and lost, then it would be a lot harder to manipulate the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yes, I
agree. I think there are going to be a lot more found. You know, I don't know. The unfortunate thing about this is that anytime I see something really weird in a sporting contest now, I'm going to wonder if there's money involved, because sometimes you're just like, what was that?
What are you thinking?
Most of the time it's going to be human error, right? It's just going to be like, oh, that's what happens. It's sports. It's pressure. But sometimes I'm like, what? That doesn't even make sense.
Well, the other thing
is the eight men out thing where they tell Seacott to like hit the first batter in the first game to show that he's in.
Yeah. To show that he's in, yeah.
There's a, you know, one of the big stories with all this is the Billups thing, which, unless I'm missing something, isn't really about sports gambling. It's just about mafia poker games where they could cheat on cards and stuff.
He was also giving injury updates to people
to the mafia
that were not public.
Wild.
He was double dipping, but yeah, that poker thing is insane.
Yeah, the poker thing.
Wild.
Yeah. That was a funny too. I think Matt Berkey on his podcast just like 2 or 3 years ago said they invited me to some game that Chauncey Billups was hosting, and he already had like heard about it, and someone told him, believe me, it's on the up and up. And the guy, and Matt Berkey was like, no, that game's not. They knew that even back then. So.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.